Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the podcast. It's been about a month since we did our last one, and we're really trying to get a little bit more consistent doing them every week, every 2 weeks. But as much as I have a lot of people lined up to do them, sometimes with my schedule, we just can't get them together. So we will get a little bit better and a little bit faster with them. But today's show is one that I've been wanting to do for a while, and we're going to be interviewing Jennifer from North Carolina. Her story is not unlike others that are in the groups that have children. And more than anything, I hope that the medical profession will listen to her story and think twice when you're about to give psychiatric medications to young women of childbearing ages, that as they have children, the difficulties they have raising them and difficulties that they decisions that they're going to have to make in their lives. Also, when the show is over, stay tuned for a postscript after the show, and we always do a little bit of a discussion afterwards. So please enjoy the show. Thank you. Hi, Jennifer. Welcome to my podcast.
Hey, Geraldine.
I'm so glad that we finally could do this, because I think your story is a one that's going to help a lot of people.
Yes.
So I usually ask people, my first question is, why were you first prescribed a benzodiazepine? And if you were prescribed anything else, feel free. You know, we can mention that too.
Okay. Well, actually, my story really starts in my early 20s. I started having flashbacks of childhood trauma, and I went to a counselor to get help for it. And she sent me to a psychiatrist who put me on Prozac. Mm-hmm. And so I was on many years of various antidepressants, and then later became a single mom. And I was going to college full time. I was working part time, and I didn't have any help raising my daughter with, you know, no family at all. It was just me and her and some friends that I had made, but they were really busy. And right. So the stress of especially college, I'm kind of a type A personality, so I wanted straight A's. So I, you know, I really pushed myself. I wanted to do well in college. I wanted to, you know, graduate, eventually get a master's degree, and have a career to raise my daughter.
Right.
And, but the stress of the school, the single motherhood, started catching up with me, and I was losing my ability to sleep real well. And I already had post-traumatic stress from childhood trauma. And so now this is more stress. And I went to a doctor, and I had anxiety, you know, already. And so I asked if there was anything that he could give me for the anxiety and to help with sleep, as long as it's not addictive. And he prescribed me an Ativan.
Wow. Now, I'm going to ask you this question. Do you feel the antidepressant helped you, or could you have handled it maybe better if you weren't on one?
Well, now that I look back at how I was on antidepressants before I ever took a benzo, I had a lot of inner restlessness. And I actually was pretty agitated a lot, although I didn't understand, you know, it was from the antidepressants. So I think a combination of the stress and years of accumulated use of the antidepressants led to my needing, you know, the benzo to help with those symptoms.
Right. And even if back then somebody had helped you with the childhood trauma, might have avoided all of this. You know, as we all look back on our lives, we say, if only this could have happened.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I went to a counselor seeking help to work through it. I'm like, I want to get through this. You know, these are memories I'm having, and I need help dealing with it. You know, I got the feelings going on and everything, and the visual memories. And instead of really helping me walk through that, she sent me to someone who drugged me, which actually shut down the whole process. And I've been trying to access that ever since, and could never do it until I've now been off all medications for many years. I'm now finally able to access it and deal with it.
Right. So when you're pregnant, what are you on at that point?
Okay. As soon as I found out I was pregnant, I quit coffee cold turkey, because intuitively I knew not to have any, you know, anything in my system that could harm the baby. And I had been on antidepressants for years up until that point, and I stopped that too.
And cold turkey.
Yeah, but I, you know, I couldn't have called, I wouldn't have called it that then. So now I'm going through hormonal changes, and I'm really whacked out.
Wow. Yeah. And okay, so you're cold turkey from coffee, the antidepressant, you do the pregnancy, and now come, you have your beautiful daughter, and and then you know all the stress, and you can't sleep, and this is now when the benzo comes in.
Right. So yeah, I grew up in Northern Virginia, and my daughter and I, she was a year and a half when we moved to Colorado. And that was in 1999. Mm-hmm. And a couple years, I nursed her. That's right. I nursed her, and she weaned herself after about 2 years. And during that time, I was not on any medications because I also knew it would go to through the milk. So as soon as she weaned, then, you know, you can imagine all the hormonal changes continued. Now I'm a single mom, you know, living out in Colorado. I don't really know anybody out there. And I went to a counselor and I asked to be put back on antidepressants because it's what I believed had helped me, you know, prior.
Right.
And then it was a couple years later after I started college, and then about 2 years into college is when I started losing my ability to sleep well at night, and I was having excessive stress related anxiety during the day, of course, as a single mom and in college. And, and then the benzos, and about 4 years on benzos altogether.
Right. So while you're on the benzos and all that, how do you notice anything? Because I noticed that I was going downhill, that I was having interdose withdrawal, I was becoming anxious, you know, because I got put on for an infection that nobody knew about. So what are you noticing while you're on the drugs and you're trying to raise your daughter?
Right. Well, the number one thing was I did not want anything addictive. Now, let me just back up for a minute. As soon as I started taking Ativan, I was amazed at how well I could sleep. Mm-hmm. So initially, it did what I was told it would do. But now keep in mind, I didn't think it was addictive. So about 4 months later, I could tell, I could just sense something was up with this drug. Like it felt addictive. And so I went back to him and I said, is there anything else? I think this is addictive. And then he didn't admit or deny. He said, oh yeah, no problem. And then he switched me to Xanax and Ambien for the next several months.
Mm-hmm. Unbelievable. That's unbelievable. Knowing what we know now, and you look and you think, how could they have done that to you?
Right.
Especially when you're raising a child alone. So, you know, you've become dependent on these. You know, I always say these are very addictive drugs, but we're not addicts. We have become dependent, physically dependent on this medication.
Correct.
So how is your appetite? What's happening while you're on this? Now he switched to Ambien and Xanax, and how are you functioning?
Right. So now that I know the language to speak, I couldn't have spoken it then. I definitely had quite a bit of interdose withdrawal. I was developing more of a tolerance. I was having a lot of akathisia. I was losing concentration. And so he switched me. So I went back to him. So a year later, these bizarre symptoms were happening. And about a year later, after he put me on Ambien and Xanax, he switched me to Ativan, back to Ativan. So he just stopped, the Ambien and the Xanax. Now we're back on Ativan. And then about 4 months later, this is all according to my records. I went through all of them. I do advise people to keep their records to make sense of this story at some point. So about 4 months later, then he switched me to Klonopin 1 milligram.
Now, you know, I'm going to ask you something. When he's switching you cold turkey from one to another, do you feel anything? Because, you know, for some people, when they switch from one benzo to another, maybe a few weeks to even a few months, something will happen. They just don't know it's from switching one drug to another. You still are withdrawing from one onto another. Some don't feel it, but some do. Did you feel anything?
Oh, yeah. I mean, as I look back, again, I didn't understand it at the time, but as I look back, absolutely. I was not well.
That's awful, awful. Yep. And so now with your daughter, it's getting hotter and hotter for you to raise her. How old is she at this point?
Oh, yeah, because by this point, I developed a really bad depersonalization, derealization. I was losing my connection to her. I was losing my connection to me, to reality. Everything seemed so far away, but yet it was right in front of me. So these were very strange, you know, symptoms. And let me just say, after he put me back on, or when he switched me to Klonopin, it was on 1 milligram, about 3 months later, he increased it to 2 milligrams and said I could start taking it more during the day. In other words, I was definitely needing more in order to just be stable. We're not talking about seeking a high here. This is just about functioning because something is different. Yeah.
Oh, it's unbelievable. Mm-hmm. And now, are you still in school at this point? Are you still trying to go to school?
Yes. I mean, miraculously, I was able to get through college and graduate. But by the time I graduated, I almost wasn't able to, because by that time, I was losing my memory. I was going into bookstores researching Alzheimer's, because I could have sworn I was developing it. And sure enough, I had all the symptoms, as I was researching it, of early stages of Alzheimer's.
Right. Actually, there's an attorney in Texas that was doing benzo cases, and he told me he had a client one time that once she came off benzo, she no longer had dementia, Alzheimer's. She was diagnosed with severe memory issues, and it was the drugs.
I believe it.
It's just ridiculous.
But I can tell you one thing. One thing I'm really grateful for is that by the time soon after I graduated, I moved from Colorado to Santa Fe because I wanted to get my master's in counseling there. It was a cheaper school to go to. So soon after I graduated, I moved. And one of the most stressful things that anyone can do, especially on benzos or in withdrawal, is move.
Move, yeah.
Right. So I did. It was only a few hours away. But after I got there, I was out of my mind from the stress. And I had to take more and I was about ready to go up to 3 milligrams now just to get to sleep at night. And all of a sudden, I look at this pill in my hand and I hear this voice that says the drug is the problem, because I had no clue. None.
Right. Up right. Until you still that hadn't point. Researched it and found anybody.
I had no idea. And that's when I came off. That's when I was just like, oh my God, if the drug is the problem, I got to get off now. And I had no idea about all the support groups. I do remember searching benzodiazepines online. I barely remember it. And I barely remember discovering the Ashton Manual. But as I started to read through it, my brain shut down. I literally could not read or comprehend anything. And so I couldn't even access it. And I just came off real quick in about 3 months, which now I know is the same as cold turkey.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you're in Santa Fe. Now, at what point do you go back to Colorado?
Right. So I moved there to get my master's degree. And 3 months and a couple months after I moved there, I'm coming off benzos and I lose all functioning. And so I never got my master's degree because I wasn't capable. And so I stayed there about almost 2 years, and the stress of living in that area, it was very stressful compared to where I had moved from. I was in Durango, Colorado, a much smaller town and much safer town. And then after being under the stress of Santa Fe and plus, you know, the move and all these crazy symptoms I'm having and benzo withdrawal, I was just like, oh my God, I got to get back to Colorado just so I can start to feel better. That's all I knew. I didn't understand I was in withdrawal. I had no idea I was still in withdrawal a couple years later, but not well at all. And so we went back to Colorado and that was, that's when we went back.
So you go back to Colorado. How old is your daughter at this point?
So she was about, she was probably about almost maybe about 8 years old. Yeah, she was about 8 at that time.
Right. And it's becoming more and more difficult for you to give her the normal life she wants, you know, that not that she wants so much as that you want to give her as a mother, right. You know, because you're sick. I mean, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. She, even on benzos, we were very bonded. And I mean, like so many of us, you know, we fall in love with the child when they're in our wombs. And right. It was a very strong bond, and especially strengthened through the 2 years of nursing. And I set out to be, you know, a good mom for her. I wanted, you know, my world revolved around her. And mm-hmm. And here I am, like, all messed up on these medications, thinking it's me, that there's something wrong with me. And meanwhile, I was disconnected. That being on these medications disconnected me from my daughter emotionally and mentally and psychologically. And so after about 2.5-3 years into withdrawal, and I had, let me back up. While in Santa Fe, I definitely lost my ability to sleep, which is common when we come off benzos. Mm-hmm. And so I went to a psychiatrist because, again, I still didn't know it was the drugs, really. And I just knew I'm off the benzo. I should be getting better. Well, about 5 months off, I'm not getting better. In fact, I'm getting worse in some ways.
Right. And so we know that's when mm-hmm. people anywhere from a couple of months to 5 to 6 right. months off, you can get sicker. Mm-hmm. You know, yep. But nobody's educating you at this point.
Nope. And that's what happened. And all I knew was I had got to hurry up and get better so I could get my master's and raise my daughter. Like, what is happening here? What is this delay? I can't function. I'm high functioning. And here I'm not functioning. It was shocking. I was in a state of shock the entire time. Even now, as I relive it, I'm still in shock over this whole thing. So
it is. It's traumatic.
Totally. And I do believe we develop post-traumatic stress from this. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So, because it's a sense of betrayal, you know, so that we survive barely. So then I went to a doctor in Santa Fe and I was put on Prozac and Trazodone. Now, I will tell you, the Trazodone did enable me to sleep. And so I don't know if I would have been able to recover sleep to the level I needed at that time without it. I cannot say, but I must also say that there were a lot of effects of those two medications that did not serve me well either. Right. So eventually I did come off of those, but temporarily, you know, I can only say for myself, it may have gotten me through. I don't know how I would have done without them. Maybe better. I don't know.
Well, yeah, I don't know if you know, but you know, my own mother, when she fell years ago and was in a rehab for a couple of months till I get there, they put her on Ambien. And once she came home, I went to Florida and I could tell she was intolerant the minute my sister brought her in the door. And so I brought her back to Boston. We weaned her off. And my mother lost the ability to sleep, and she never had a problem sleeping. And so my neighbor, who is a doctor, had suggested Trazodone, and that was the only thing. We waited a while, and she just couldn't sleep. She lost her ability because of Ambien.
Wow.
So, you know, I don't think any of us are against medication when you have got to survive. You are a single mother, and you needed sleep. You were trying to get better. So it's an individual decision. Nobody has a right to criticize anybody for what they do.
No, definitely not. And my motives were completely good, as most of us are. You know, I wanted to sleep good at night so I could make it to class the next day, graduate, get a career, get married, you know, have a good life. Mm-hmm. It's what everyone wants. And I took it as prescribed. Always. I was a great patient. Yeah.
Always. And I think now at the point you're back in Colorado is when you and I then meet, right? Mm-hmm. We become friends on I think my support group, right, back then?
Well, let's
see. Who can even remember after all these years?
Yeah. It was in the protracted withdrawal support group on Facebook.
Okay.
Yeah. What happened was I had been, like most of us, we get diagnosed fibromyalgia and or chronic fatigue syndrome. Well, of course, in benzo withdrawal, I got diagnosed both of those. And so I was in a Facebook group for people with fibromyalgia, and my symptoms were just relentless and ongoing from these benzos. And I don't know what sparked this thought, but all of a sudden, like, I thought, search benzodiazepines in Facebook. And I had been about 5 years off of benzos at this time. And so I typed in benzodiazepines, and I don't even know why I'm doing this, really. And then I discovered a benzo withdrawal support group. And there was 100 members at the time. And now it's up to like 2,000 plus or more, way more. And so I joined that group, and I was like, oh my God, there's an actual support group for this. And I started reading the post. And I mean, I screamed bloody murder. I was insane and out of my mind to discover, my God, it really was the benzos. And I'm reading my symptoms. I'm reliving them over and over through all these comments in there. Yeah. And so then I joined, and then I found out, then I started doing mad research on benzos and, you know, other psychiatric medications as well to try to make sense of the bigger picture. I mean, I even researched up to the drug companies. I went as far as I could go with it, and I did find out and understood about protracted withdrawal syndrome. I joined a group at that time, the protracted withdrawal syndrome support group on Facebook, and there was a post going in there between me and some others about our children. And I think I was really upset about, oh my God, I lost my child to this. And then you jumped in and commented, and then you and I took off from there. Yeah.
Right. So now, talking about your daughter. So one of the hardest decisions I think a mother ever has to make is you want the best for your daughter. So I think one of the main things with this podcast, we want people to know that this horrific decision that you had to make, which was really for the best for your daughter. So do you want to tell us about that and how you came to make the decision of to give your daughter the best that she could have for her future?
Yes. Okay. So we moved. So I graduated from college. We moved to Santa Fe so I could get my master's. Almost 2 years later, we moved back to Colorado because I can't tolerate the stress of this big city life. And then a few months later, of course, now we've got the stress of moving back under my belt, and I'm actually declining even more. And I am like pretty much bedridden. And really, I had been for the most part homebound since coming off benzos. So we're up to about three and a half years off now, back in Colorado. And a few months later, my daughter started displaying some warning signs that all children display when they're not getting their needs met at home, you know, even just needs for comfort, emotional connection, verbal communication. I couldn't drive her to her events. I had to have people come pick her up to take her to things. And couldn't even always arrange that. So she didn't go to a lot of things. And I couldn't go to the events and root her on at different things. I could hardly support her in much of anything, let alone even really take care of myself. And so I saw things getting worse, rapidly getting worse. And I wanted her to be cared for. That's all I ever wanted. And I was losing confidence in my ability to care for her. I kept trying and trying. And the more I tried, actually, the worse I was getting. Right. And the guilt, the more, you know, the increased guilt and shame of like, my God, what's wrong with me? I'm in love with my daughter and I can't even care for her. And so everything was getting worse. Finally, one day I went to a pastor at a church. And I told him everything that was happening and my concerns for my daughter and how unwell I was and how I just surrendered. I said, I give up. I don't know what to do. And I cannot care for this child. And he looked at me and he said, do you want me to help you? And I said, yes, help her. And then he told me about a children's home in Longmont, Colorado, which was about 7 hours north of me. And it's a Christian-based children's home, which I was very happy about. And he gave me the phone number. I called. I interviewed the place. I talked with the counselor up there. And everything was going good. I sounded good. I asked all the right questions, got all the right answers. The most important answer I needed was, I won't lose custody. And they assured me that I would not. So, you know what? I got to back up. This is not the first time I relinquished her. The very first time I relinquished her to foster care was when she was 9 years old. I apologize. I got off track there. So she was 9 years old, and I called social services, and I had to put her into foster care through social services was the first time. And then she was in there for about 9 months with a wonderful Christian family, and they wanted to adopt her. And I said, no, I don't want her adopted. I said, I just need, you know, temporary foster care. And if you want to adopt her, I would need some kind of legal document stating that I'll still be able to keep seeing her. It's the worst thing for us to be completely separated. And she could not assure me that she would do that. So then I took her back. Okay. So then from age 9 until 13 is when I continued to try to mother her while pretty homebound.
Right. I don't know how you did it, because I was in the same boat, and I could, if I did not have the help, I could not have raised my kids. So at least I got to be at home with them, with everybody helping me. You know, mm-hmm. It takes a village.
Absolutely. I didn't even have much of a village without the Benzo story. And then you add that on top of it. It was impossible. Absolutely impossible. So I took her back after 9 years in foster care. And that was extremely traumatic for both of us to be separated.
So not nine, just when she was 9 years old. For right. How many months was she in foster care?
Right. So the first time around was 9 months. And then when they wanted to adopt her and block me out of her life until she's 18, I said no. Yeah. And I took her back because I never wanted to let her go, ever. I would have never done such a thing.
No.
And so I took her back. And then about 3 years later, she's declining. And I'm not getting better. Both of us are getting worse. And then when she was age 13, I went to the pastor and I tried to get help for her. And he hooked me up to this children's home and he drove her there for me. And that was extremely traumatic for both of us again. But she got the care she needed. And she was in there from age 13 until 18. And the people that helped raise her in there, she ended up adopting them as her own family.
So nothing legally, just that became her family. Right. And,
right.
And how is your relationship? And I know I was on the phone with you a lot back then. I know how hard all of this was for you, and nothing that you would have wanted. You know, this iatrogenic illness stole a lot from you.
Everything, Geraldine, everything, my career, my health, the worst, my daughter. Right. I was never able to have a healthy relationship, get married. That was one of my dreams. You know, I was a mess. Right. And she lost her mother. I mean, she suffered huge loss.
She did. And I know you try to constantly stay in touch and do things, but there's, you know, a lot of things. I ask people that have kids when we're doing this, what's the relationship now with your daughter? Because, you know, we know that a lot of people have a hard time with their relationship with their kids as a result of this. How is the relationship today?
Right. Absolutely. And I can just say, because she was in that children's home, I was allowed to and encouraged to fly her home and go visit her there, stay in touch by email, by phone. Sometimes we did counseling sessions by phone as well. So we did stay pretty well connected. Mm-hmm. I wasn't able to travel much because I was so sick, but I could fly her home. So that kept us from being completely severed. But the chances of so many people in benzo withdrawal with kids in my situation of finding a place like this are nearly impossible. And they only take 7 kids at a time. And so that the fact that there was even an opening was miraculous. Right. So she's in there until 18. And then they helped get her into college in Arkansas. And so she was in college for, a couple of years. And then I thought, I wanted to move back east to be with my family. And then I figured when she graduates from college in Arkansas, she would come to North Carolina, which I have now moved to North Carolina as of 2 years ago. And I wanted her to come join us after she graduated. Instead, she has now moved to Idaho, where her surrogate family lives. And so where we are today is every once in a while I'll hear from her, but it's usually from me texting her. I do send her gifts. We are on each other's Facebook. We share each other's, an account online. We don't have that bond, that I was used to before I had to let her go.
She's a grown woman now. And I know this, looking from others, they are resentful for not being able to be with their mothers. But, as you were talking, I'm thinking, you were sick. You did the best you could for her. But there are families that send their kids off to boarding school and the kids don't resent that. But because we're sick somehow, there's resentment for a lot of the moms on Facebook. I mean, there are some that did great. The families understood. And I think it's the ones that have family that come and surround them. So something you and I talked about earlier, because you're not the only one who had to make this very difficult decision. If the church or there were agencies that would send somebody, caretakers in to help get kids ready to go to school or help when they came home, none of this would have had to happen. Somebody to help, if you had cancer, they'd send people to help you raise your daughter. Right. And there's something's got to be done. And I know you're one of the ones, you did advocacy work in Colorado. You're doing some in North Carolina. You've done great work, even being sick. And, I hope that from this, if there are some agencies that listen to it, to do something to help mothers that have been made iatrogenically ill, to give them help at home to keep their children at home. Because my kids, because I did have the help, I didn't lose my relationships with my children. It very well could have happened if I was a single mom.
Exactly. And from all the years I've been involved in the online benzo groups and connected to people by phone, I can, from what I have seen, a lot of people do have support. But then there are some of us that don't. And basically we need home health aides coming to our homes. Right. We need people to take our kids to school sometimes, to go to events with them, to drive us sometimes.
To drive us, right. Yes. As I didn't go to school events. I had to be driven. I lost the ability to drive. This is a real illness that is caused by these psychiatric medications. So, these are just things that you and I will be fighting for, probably till the day we die. Right. It's not that it's going to help us, but we need to help the ones coming behind because they're still coming. Right. Sadly enough, after all these years, they're still coming. So just quickly, I want to talk about a little bit about setbacks, because you mentioned moving when you moved to Santa Fe, how hard that was coming back to Colorado. And then when you made the decision to move to North Carolina, where you would get some help. A lot of people get worried about setbacks. Is it going to happen? I've been under a lot of stress. I think we learn to protect ourselves, but that's an overwhelming thing to move. So I know a lot of people get fearful of setbacks, but you know how to treat yourself, right? You know how to help yourself, even though there are sometimes a setback from these major stresses in our lives because your nervous system still isn't 100%, correct?
Absolutely. I have, if I have it the last time I checked, I have about 13 years off of benzodiazepines, mm-hmm. and I have about 8 years off of antidepressants and mm-hmm. no other psychiatric medication since then. And, you know, in some ways by the year, I've gotten better and better. I've gained greater access to my true self, my emotional life, my memories. Memory has improved some. Mm-hmm. And I feel way more connected to other people. I don't feel the derealization, the depersonalization. That's pretty much gone. However, while being really homebound, I learned to rearrange my life to manage my symptoms. So that includes not going out in mornings, make all appointments in the afternoons. That includes eliminate all stressors. And in my case, the stress of being a mother had to go in order to just survive and of course, create a good life for her. And stimulus, I'm very, very sensitive to stimulus, bright lights, sudden movements, sudden loud noises, things like that. Driving is very stressful. So anytime I do go through a major stress, like moving from Colorado to North Carolina, I have experienced a setback since I've moved here, for sure. And the thing that happens a lot with us is we learn to better manage our symptoms. We start to feel better. And then as we start to feel better, we think we can maybe take on a little more. And then we test the waters, you know, and sometimes we can do a little more and sometimes we set back. So this move cross country was definitely hard on my nervous system. The extreme stress, bodily stress responses did kick back in for sure, which just tells me that, you know, some of that damage is still with me. I have the heart tachycardia. Mm-hmm. I've had a lot of heart racing, increased blood pressure since I've moved here. So but the good news is that I know what to do. I know how to manage. And the truth is, extreme stress isn't good for anybody, benzo or not compromised. That's so, right.
And you were cold turkey. I mean,
right.
There was no information, you know, for me. And for you, I think the information was probably just coming out, but you didn't even still know you were iatrogenically ill. So, mm-hmm. you know, you weren't even tapered properly, which is a shame. And we're trying, this is part of what you and I have been doing. We trying to do legislation. We want more education. We want people trained in how to help people come off these drugs.
Right.
You've given back so much, you know, when so much was taken away from you.
Yeah, I mean, that's the best I can do. What is that saying? Mm-hmm. You know, if somebody dies, we don't want them to die in vain. Well, my life died. My life absolutely died. And so the best I can do is, you know, assist others in their process in whatever way I can, you know, as I'm guided to do that mm-hmm. at any given day. And I'm always happy to help somebody. Every once in a while, someone will refer somebody to me, and I am forever grateful. And it gives meaning, you know, to the horror of my story. So, because without
that, all of us, it does. We've all wanted to give back. You know, we all want to stop somebody else from suffering the way that we did.
You bet. Absolutely. And there's been many, many times where people didn't start taking benzos because of my story, you know, I told my story. So I believe we're not to keep quiet, you know,
about this. Things are happening. Things are slowly mm-hmm. happening. All right. So I know whenever we do a podcast, when we end, we always say afterwards, there's so much we could have talked about, but I think we really covered about everything right now. And if we can always do another show, because I think this is going to help a lot of people who are struggling. Yeah. And I think they might have some thoughts about where to go to get help if they aren't doing it. And I'm hopefully going to be having somebody on who was alone and brought people in to help her. She didn't have to leave her home. So I'm hoping I can get her soon. And is there anything final that you'd want to say, Jennifer?
Yeah, I just want to say, you know, I'm not mad or upset at my daughter choosing a foster family that she has adopted by choice, not legally, right. but in, you know, by choice.
Right.
And she does call someone else mom. And there are days that I completely lose it over that. I mean, the grief that it comes in waves. I mean, like right now I'm functioning. Tomorrow I could be like losing it all day long because, oh my God, I lost my daughter. It just like grief, it goes on forever and it does come in waves. And through this entire grieving process, I never, ever am upset with her for, you know, for maybe not talking to me as much as I wish she would, you know, or anything like that, because this child still lives with the wounds of having lost her mother first, most of her early childhood while I was on the medication. Second, the first time in foster care from age 9 and 10, almost 1 year. And then third, she comes back home for about 3 years and still doesn't have me, you know, really. Mm-hmm. And then she loses me again into foster care for the second time from age 13 to 18. She's now in her early 20s. She has never had her mother on the meds or off, living with me or not. So I just pray for her that God would completely heal her wounds. And
I think she will. Yeah, I think her. I think she'll come back to you. I mean, she's going to be, you know, she's a grown woman now. So here's a question I want to ask you. Do you think the trauma of you having not having your daughter with you has been part of what's this trauma? I know you had your childhood trauma, but this trauma, which, like you say, it's a constant wound, is hindering your healing.
Yeah, because honestly, the longer I'm off those all those medications, the more I am feeling, and my recovery from these medications is coming off in layers.
Right.
You know, I think I've cried so much that there's nothing left, you know, and then inevitably there's another layer at some point. So it is ongoing because not only was my daughter's mother stolen from her, my motherhood was stolen from me and the chance of ever getting married and, you know, creating a family for her as well. This is a loss that's forever. I can't go back and do those years again. And I can say to a certain degree, I almost feel well enough to mother her now. And she's gone.
And she's gone, right. Yeah, and there were so many in the groups that they were drugged during their years where they would want to get pregnant. And now those women have lost the chance to have children. I just hope more and more professionals will listen to these podcasts and listen to these real life stories of how when you drug somebody 20 years ago, the effect it can still have today.
Absolutely. Yes.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you, Jennifer, so much for being on and for telling your story. And if we think later on, we can always add to this and have you back another time.
That would be great. Thank you so much, Geraldine. I appreciate
it. Jennifer. Okay. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Bye-bye.
All right, Garrett, so we just finished our interview with Jennifer in North Carolina, and I think in all the years that you've heard different people calling here, especially moms, because you've talked to a few of them on the phone, they wanted to get your opinion as a child, and when you hear her story, you think, that could have happened to us if we didn't have the help that we had. And I don't think you knew about Jennifer. You know, you know some of the benzo people, but you had never heard what happened to her and what the decision she had to make to give her daughter a better life.
Yeah, so this is the first show that we did where I didn't know anything about the guest, so we didn't exchange show notes. We usually will email or whatever it is before the show, and I'll learn more about people. If I didn't know them beforehand, I'll learn more through your notes or your introduction. So this is the first one that I kind of heard it the same way that people on the podcast are hearing about it, and I think it's probably everybody's, I'm not going to say number one fear, but it's close, right? That you're going to lose your family, you're going to lose your kids. And in this case, it did happen. You know, the nightmare happened.
Right. And it's not so much she lost it, her child. She had to make the decision to give her child a better life. And it was one that I feared all the time. I used to say, if I wasn't married, I couldn't have raised you kids. So it's heartbreaking. And I hope the medical profession that listens to this podcast and sees you know, the effect that drugs can have. I remember one time I was invited to go speak up in Maine, and when they used to have a group up there, and I wanted to bring you guys and say, when you drug somebody, when somebody's sitting in your office, here's the whole family. It's going to affect everybody. You know, it trickles down.
Yeah. I can say, I think as I'm listening to the interview, I'm hoping that the story is going to change and that there's going to be a happy ending. And, you know, hopefully there is eventually for her and her daughter. But, you know, as it is right now, you know, it's a difficult situation. And
she's heartbroken.
Right. And
I hope that, I always said to her, the older her daughter gets, that she will learn. And there's going to be more and more on the media. There's more and more on the internet. Her daughter is going to learn what happened to her mother. I think there will be a really good reconciliation there at some point. Obviously, they live in different states now, like a lot of people when your children move away. Mm. But she lost a lot over
the
years.
Did she say how old she is, their daughter?
I think she said she's 22 now.
Okay, so still, you know, pretty young. And, you know, there's time, hopefully, that she can, you know, she'll learn more about what her mother went through. And that's not me putting all the blame on her, that it's up to her to forgive her mother or anything like that.
No.
It's just, I think, you know, dealing with full information on the situation that she came out of is always very helpful
right.
in trying to heal. So if it's a case like that where eventually, you know, she kind of comes to terms with everything that was going on in her mother's life, then maybe things change.
Maybe someday when she becomes a mother. In fact, we have one of the other moms in the group that all four of her children went into foster care when she was sick. They're all still angry at her. She's healthy now. The mother is healthy, but they all resent what happened. And the mothers are suffering the loss of their children. And this is all because of medication, where Jennifer, really, if somebody just helped her deal with the trauma, she shouldn't have been drugged. And in fact, there's so much information out now where you're not supposed to drug trauma victims. You're supposed to help them through it.
Yeah, and I think that's probably a running theme in a lot of the people that we've had on so far. It's that everybody seems to have to go through it alone. You know, when you're going through it, there are other things going on in America right now, like say with the opioid epidemic. If you were to go to somebody and say, I'm hooked on heroin, there would be a number of people that you could go to that would help you. You could go to a support group.
Right.
And everybody would understand the problem that you're going through. They really don't understand this one. So
no.
Everybody is left to do it on their own.
Right.
Which is one of the hardest things, because you feel alone in it. You feel crazy.
Yeah, I did. I felt crazy. But I got good help because I couldn't raise you guys. I couldn't drive. I couldn't go to anything. You know, just like her, same thing. And if it wasn't for family, I probably would have had to make the same decision, something, if I didn't grow up around here and raise my kids in the same place. You know, she really made the best decision for her daughter. It wasn't for her because it hurt her, you know. But I hope a lot of good comes out of this because, you know, legislation is starting to happen here in Boston, correct? So she's been working on stuff where she lived in Colorado and now in North Carolina. I hope it brings awareness down the road of the long-term effects that this can have, not just physically, mentally, to the children of people that you're drugging.
Yeah.
All right. So I think it was a great show, and it's going to, I think it's going to help a lot of people that are struggling with the same problem.
I think so, too. All right.
All right. Good show. Thank you again, Garrett.
Thank you.